What does it take to make a positive change in your life? That's the question that keeps people reading and writing self-help books and attending all kinds of weekend seminars. To quit smoking, to have better relationships, to feel empowered in their careers. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, playwright David Wayne Reed joins us to talk about the inspiration for his new play, Help Yourself, all about how different people tackle the project of bringing about change in their lives. We'll also have a librarian and a psychologist in the studio to talk about the self-help genre, and we'll want your insights too. Stay with us.
We are nothing more than our stories. We are 7 billion little stories running rampant in this world.
So says Gabe Newland, author, visionary, and motivational speaker.
Do you like the story you're writing? Would you read it? Would it be a bestseller?
We're at one of Gabe Newland's weekend seminars. It's called Understanding Simplified. Actually, this is part of a new play opening this weekend called Help Yourself, and all the action takes place at Gabe's weekend seminar. Let's listen in to a little more of that pep talk that opens the session.
Here's the thing, folks. Life is just one big metaphor. Life is a choose-your-own-adventure book. Life is just a story. You are the lead character. You are the writer. You are the great American novel. Each and every one of you. So who's the hero of your story? Is it you? Because if it isn't, it should be.
Are you motivated now? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're going to talk about self-help. What are its possibilities, its limitations, and where's the theater in it? Our first guest is David Wayne Reed. Understanding Simplified and the self-help guru behind it are his inventions. He's the author of that play, Help Yourself. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for being here. I know it must be a really busy week for you.
It's been a crazy week. You know, we've started tech rehearsals over the weekend and adding in costumes, lights, sounds, and my actors are all so fantastic. I'm really getting excited for this show.
That's great. So give us the quick and dirty of the setup. What can you tell people without spoiling too much about the premise of this play?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it. The premise is basically a nurse, a recovering alcoholic, and a meteorologist attend a transformational seminar.
Why a meteorologist?
Why not? Why not a meteorologist?
I can't help but ask. I was just reading a book the other night where someone described a character as like a meteorologist, and it seems like that's a type.
It is a type, I suppose. I was actually inspired by a local news person. I've been inspired by a lot of local happenings that I think people will see in this show. And so I have several muses that have contributed to this show.
It sounds like you're not wanting to name names on the weather person. Any other of the local happenings you'd care to draw our attention to, or just let it be a surprise?
Just things that I hear, you know, just like other people's problems. Other people's problems, it's a rich cesspool to choose from. There's so much inspiration. There's no lack of problems. And so I just kind of found some of my favorites and dressed them in different clothes and had fun with them.
So we're going to wade in this cesspool with you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Okay. What got you interested in doing a play about self-help in particular?
Several years ago, I attended a transformational seminar, and I really liked the construct of it, you know, and I love, even before that, though, I loved makeover shows. I love Oprah's, you know, the whole religion of Oprah and her congregants and that whole idea. And I think
when you say that whole idea, can you flesh out what you mean a little bit more?
The whole idea of just self-help. I mean, it's everywhere. And we don't even know it. It's on billboards. It's in offhanded conversations. It's on Oprah's new chai tea at Starbucks. Self-help is everywhere.
And a theater of self-help is what it sounds like. Because when you talk about a show, like a reality show, you're not just talking about a personal experience. You're talking about something that an audience is vicariously, like, experiencing.
Right. I think that when there's a real payoff and a real excitement when we watch a show and we get ready for the makeover moment, it's really exciting. And it's like we get to cheat our own transformations. We can experience a transformation without having to do any of the hard work, our hard emotional work ourselves. It's just a quick fix.
I have a confession for you, which is that I haven't actually seen a ton of these reality shows you're describing. So when you say makeover moment, can you tell me more about what that moment is? What are the ingredients of the makeover moment?
Well, usually it's a new haircut, it's a dye job, it's a new outfit. But really behind that, it's how that makeover transforms them. I think the exciting part is when they see themselves in the mirror for the first time, and it's that recognition that they are a different person now, or at least they can be a different person now. There's something really exciting about that transformational moment that I think drives everybody wild, the viewer as well as the participant. And that's what I noticed in this transformational seminar. You see people, there would be people sharing their problems, and you kind of found yourself rooting for them. But
what's the format? How are they sharing their problems? Is it like one at a time they volunteer to go up? Are they dragged out of the crowd? And
well, like in Oprah, just take the Oprah show, for example. You know, someone steps up to the microphone and says, I was, you know, a drunk mother of four, and then I had a car crash and I had my aha moment and I pulled it all together. It's kind of like that.
Okay.
This was, I mean, I think many of them are like that. The Tony Robbins, Live Your Best Life, even Wayne Dyer on KCPT, you know, his specials that he does. It's a pretty popular construct.
So how did you end up at this seminar?
Through some well-meaning friends who thought that I could go for a change in my life. And they were right. I could. But I wasn't ready for... You know, I think we all want change, but when it stares us in the face, it's like, I don't know, I'm scared, I don't think so. And I think what these weekend seminars do is they expedite the process, kind of push you to your transformation just a little bit quicker. You might get to it on your own time through a New Year's resolution, or you could go to a weekend transformational seminar and really take control of your life in that moment.
Do you feel like that was beneficial to you when you went to that, or was it because you were kind of on some level dragged there? Did that affect what you got from it?
No, I think when you get there, you want the experience. It's like you've paid to go to the amusement park, so you're going to get on the roller coaster because you paid, and you're going to get your transformation, by golly, and so let's do this. So no, it was good. That was in the late 90s, and it's not to say that I haven't had a myriad of problems since then. It's not a fix-all, but I think that's kind of the trick of self-help, is that problems are the gasoline that runs the self-help car. There's no shortage of problems, and so self-help can continue to be an $8 billion a year industry. And really looking at that, it's like the problems are perpetuated as much as they're fixed.
So did you have any particular problems at that time that were solved by that seminar? And if so, I wonder if you can, like, take us through how that worked.
Boy, it's been a long time ago. I remember at that time, I'm really being vulnerable now, but I think what I recall remembering about it was I realized that I had some real issues with not feeling good enough. And that was a really pretty common sentiment among other people. And so I kind of learned how – I was like, oh, yeah, you know what? I am good enough to deserve these things. Right on. I'm going to take control of my life.
Your posture and everything sounds like – I mean, you're being very sincere, but at the same time, like, there's a certain level of recognition that it might sound funny, or there might be something funny about that. Can you talk about that?
Well, it is funny. I mean, when people change, it's really jarring to the people around them. And that was a real jumping off point for this play, because you change and then you go home to your family and they're like, who is this person? You're like, I'm living my best life now. And people are like, wow, well, just last week you were really down in the dumps and not your fullest expression of yourself. And now here you are. And that can be really, that creates a dissonance. And when other people change and you don't change, it causes problems, which I have highlighted in my show.
Okay, so let's get back to your show. A motivational guru is such an intense personality, or at least my idea of one is. I think about, like, the Tom Cruise character in the movie Magnolia, mm-hmm. all bluster and certainty and charisma, but kind of a phony charisma, well-rehearsed pacing and hand gestures and pauses. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So how did you work with that kind of archetype?
I wanted him to be sincere. And, you know, I had a first reading of this play at the Fish Tank the end of November. And some of the audience members asked me after, they said, do you believe in what your person says? And I've said, oh, absolutely. I love everything. And I believe in everything that Gabe Newlin says. And so, I mean, it's a comedy, but there's also real truth in what he's saying. And I think there's truth in what all of these gurus are saying. It's just how they relay the information. You can get the same information, but, you know, just looking at, I mean, Oprah is very different than Tony Robbins in their approach. It's just, how do you like to be spoon-fed your self-help? Who do you like to receive it from?
Yeah, well, and you also must have had to dig pretty deep in creating this as a really three-dimensional character. You would have had to dig deep down to ask yourself, what would motivate someone to be this kind of person, to stand up in front of other people and give instructions on life? Did you come to any answers on that?
I kind of kept him a little bit mysterious. We don't know too much about him. And I know of self-help leaders that I've followed. You don't know too much about him. I think it actually helps that they're enshrouded in a little bit of mystery. And so Jeff Smith's character, Gabe Newland, really comes out of the gate and he doesn't have to explain. He tells you how to live your best life without ever giving away too much of himself.
And does he have to live his best life?
I think he does. I mean, he obviously does. Or people wouldn't buy his millions of books.
Right. Good point. Well, so tell me more about the program that he espouses, Understanding Simplified, which is a very funny title.
It's very simple to understand, right? That's the tagline. Understanding Simplified. Well, as you played in the recording, I based his whole seminar on dramatic structure, the whole idea of dramatic structure and rewriting your story. And we are just a bunch of pronouns, and we have falling action, rising action. I think he says climaxes, if you're lucky, and resolution. And those are all parts of dramatic structure, and that's how
we can rewrite our lives. Do we always get resolution?
I think we get little resolutions, a series of tiny resolutions that might just be good enough for then.
So we heard a little bit of the opening monologue that your self-help guru character, Gabe, uses to open those seminars. I want to play a little bit more of that speech, okay?
Sure.
So let's listen to a bit of a monologue from Help Yourself opening this weekend. Leading into this clip, Gabe has asked his minions what stories they tell themselves.
These are big questions. Are you big enough, brave enough, to rewrite your answers? You're sitting there thinking, that all sounds good, but he doesn't know my story. Let me tell you, I already know your stories. I've heard them all before, and they're all terrible. And that's good. All great stories start with terrible things. Anyone here ever read Dickens? Anyone ever watch a crime show? They all start with a death, a misfortune that befalls our hero. It is that misfortune that sets the story in motion. The problem always changes the course. The problem begets a change. There can be no end. Only change. Only a new beginning.
So, David, that is your self-help guru character delivering his opening speech in his Understanding Simplified seminar. What do you think about this idea that some terrible thing has to happen for change to occur, for real change to occur?
I look back on my life and I think of times when really terrible things happened to me, and almost when identifying those, I think of what happened right after that, then the months after that, or even the day after that, the year after that, and it was always a huge positive came from that.
Is there any shortcut that can get you out of the terrible, awful thing, or is that what self-help tries to be on some level?
I think it tries to be, but I think it really, when he said it takes a bravery, I think, and that's kind of a Buddhist principle. You have to move through the pain. You can't jump over the pain. You can't go around the pain or under the pain. To really work through the pain, you have to move through the pain. And I think that these transformational seminars or even these makeovers, it forces you. You're going to sit down and you're going to change. And you're going to confront this painful experience, because there's no way to help yourself around it except for going right through it and confronting it head on.
So this idea that we should all be the heroes of our own story, what is the working definition of hero there? Because that can sound like this self-aggrandizing idea.
Well, I think it's all a little bit self-aggrandizing. It's help yourself. It's called help yourself because at the end of the day, all you do is help yourself. You're not helping others. I mean, you're the hero of your own story. So it is very myopic. But I think that's okay. I mean, that's the crux of it.
Yeah. It's all me, right?
It's all me.
No, it's all me.
Well, you have people who say, I think it's a real victim mentality for people to put off, I can't do this because my husband won't let me do this, or I can't do this because I've got kids. That's putting it off on someone else. And I think what Gabe would say is you have to stop making it about them. You can't own your own story while you're putting it off on somebody else.
So this play is kind of a departure for you. Do you want to talk a little bit about how and maybe even why Help Yourself differs from some of your previous work, which is maybe a little more in the off-the-cuff humor kind of way?
Sure. This is very different for me. I come from writing Mother Trucker and Mother Trucker 2 Ride On, or doing White Nose Christmas and Bump at the Fish Tank. I guess the through line of all of my work is I'm really interested in communities' different languages. Like, there's the trucker language. There's also the pop culture language and tabloid culture language that we explored in White Nose Christmas. And then with this, there's the self-help language. And I'm really interested in how people speak to each other in those different vernaculars. And so that's really what drew me to this. And also when I went to this transformational retreat, seeing how it is, and there's the leader on stage, there's the audience, and then there are microphones. It's like kind of like church, which church has its origin in theater. And so I think that really inspired me for this show.
After the many months you've spent immersed in thought about all this stuff about self-help and writing a dark comedy about it, do you have any cautionary words for those people out there who might have some very good reasons for wanting to make changes in their lives before they head down the self-help road?
No, I think change is always beneficial. Change is always a changing. I think it's all good. It's a rocky road, but I think anything worth it is a rocky road.
Well, David Wayne Reed, thanks so much.
Thank you, Gina. Thank you.
David's new play, Help Yourself, opens Friday at the Paragraph Gallery and runs through February 2nd. For details, go to the Web Street of the Charlotte Street Foundation, charlottestreet.org. When we return, we'll open up this conversation about self-help. How do you use it? What are its limits? Call 816-235-2888. Central Standard. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's conversation is all about self-help. I'm joined in the studio by a couple of guests who bring different perspectives on the subject. First, it's my pleasure to introduce Katie Stover. She's the manager of reader services at the Kansas City Public Library, so she knows what's on the shelf, how often it's checked out, and what people out there in our city are looking for, self-help-wise and otherwise. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Gina.
So tell us a little bit about how self-help books are collected and organized at the library.
In the library. The self-help section in the Dewey classification is one of the first numbers that all library staff, from pages up to directors, learn. Because it's a running joke with library folks. I mean, the people looking for self-help have to ask for help to find those shelves. So we have that number memorized. It's 158.1 and 158.4. So, and usually that's all those folks need. And that those shelves are the most closely browsed, and that section is one of the most popular in library collections when we break down the circulation stats to have a look at that. And of course, it's January, so that section is seeing a bump in circ right about now.
Resolution
time. And what we recall, what we're learning in libraries, or what we've always known, is that while the 158s is where you put all the general self-help, that's where you'll find all the classics. Self-help is scattered throughout all of the nonfiction collection. We were talking that DIY is a form of self-help. Nutrition and diet books, self-help. The makeover books that were mentioned earlier in the show, that's a form of self-help.
So when you say that every section within nonfiction has a self-help subsection, does that mean like if there's an area where it's all about birds? And there is such an area.
Oh, yes, there is.
When you get to the end of it, is there a section that's like make your own bird feeder or something like that? Is that self-help?
Make your own bird feeder will actually fall in the 600s because it's more of a – you don't want this nerdy stuff, Gina.
I do, but also explain to me exactly yes. What you mean. Can you give an example
sure.
of a nonfiction section that has some self-help category within it?
Well, we can do science, mostly in the sciences with astronomy, how to recognize the stars in the sky. There'll be more how-to. How-to is a form of self-help. Cookbooks are a form of self-help. So, of course, you find it there. Diet, nutrition, in sports, how to improve your swing, how to improve your kick, how to improve your stroke, constantly there. And in the 800s were all the poetry, prose, plays, how to be a better actor, how to work your voice, how to write better poems. There's whole shelves on how to write narrative nonfiction, how to write better creative fiction. In travel, and there's plenty of how to road trip with children.
I have a friend who loves instructional books like that, which I guess I hadn't thought of as self-help, but you're right. It is a form of it. And her theory was that she liked a book that could tell you exactly how to do something, and that she had learned to sew, and that she was told that if she did every step perfectly, she would end up with perfect pants. And she called her theory perfect pants. And she believed perfect pants were achievable in all areas of life.
Well, one of the things I have learned just from chatting with patrons and from flipping through some of these DIY books myself is that most of the readers are picking and choosing what they want to take with them. They're not reading the books from cover to cover. They're probably reading the first couple of chapters and then flipping through to the other chapters that'll answer their questions. So if she read that book from beginning to end and did every single step for perfect pants and didn't get perfect pants, then our inclination as readers, as self-helpers, is to blame ourselves or think, oh, okay, I missed a chapter. I missed a step in there. If she did do that, then my gut tells me that she's got an innate talent for sewing. And because usually the first time with a lot of these DIY books, we're not getting it right the first time around. And that's why we have these DIY books.
So we'll get more insights from Katie shortly, but we have another guest in the studio this morning, so let's meet her too. Nancy Murdoch joins us from UMKC. She's a psychologist and a professor in the School of Education. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
So you've written a book on theories of counseling, offering different models for how people change. Can you outline some of the main storylines for how people change? What tends to inspire change in people's lives?
That's a really difficult question, because I can tell you that in that book there are 17 chapters with 16 different models of change. So it depends on who you look at in the book. I guess you have to assume that somebody's going to have some kind of motivation to start with, but then it depends on sort of their tendencies or who they are in terms of which model may help them best. We actually do know that most of these models, all of the models, produce positive change in people. 16, I'm sorry, 16.
That is a lot. I mean, because you hear people say people don't change. Mm-hmm. And yet you have a book with 16 models for 16 different ways in which people do, in fact, change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I have to say, you know, I'm in the business of helping people change, so I have to kind of be committed to that ideology. But in reality, we do have empirical research that supports the validity of change per se. The support for the validity of the models themselves is not quite as strong.
Tell me about the data that supports the idea that people change. What kind of data?
We actually go out and we do studies of this sort of thing. We go get a bunch of clients and we give them one kind of therapy and then we have another group that we give either no therapy or a different kind of model, if you will. And then we follow them over time, in some cases up to 5 years, to see if they change during treatment. And then in follow-ups, so 3, 4, 5 years out from treatment, is the change maintained?
So this is in the context of treatment with a therapist, it sounds
Correct.
Like. Are there scenarios where a self-help book might be the place to turn for help with bringing about change, and scenarios where that might not be a sufficient course of action?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, definitely. I was thinking about this just yesterday, because we do have actual studies on self-help models as how effective they are in terms of helping people change. We have data that says these things do help, particularly in mood and anxiety disorders. We show that self-help models do promote change. And I think they're probably real helpful if people are for some reason hesitant to go to a therapist. And there are a number of reasons for that. Or if they're in an underserved area, self-help might just be the thing. There are all kinds of what they call computerized self-help. It's internet-based self-help kind of programs. And so that might just be the thing. Or for people who historically don't trust the therapeutic community because they're seen as the man. The man, if you took the word right out of my mouth.
Well, what about you out there? What made you realize you needed a change, and how did you bring it about? Have you found self-help to be helpful or not so much? Tell us about it at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And Nancy, we had David Wayne Reed, the playwright, in here recently, and we heard him talk about the role of something bad happening in that process of deciding to make change, or just having change happen kind of naturally. Can you talk about the role of a bad thing happening in changing your life?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's almost maybe a given that when something bad happens, it's an automatic examination. Matter of fact, we know that people tend to try to make attributions for a negative event that occurs in their lives. And it depending on where you make that attribution, whether it's your fault or it's something in the environment, that can spur people to go for help. And most often does, I think.
Can you just wake up one morning and think to yourself, you know, I think I'd like to, say, be healthier, and I'm going to eat well, and not have some event in your life, like a visit to the doctor, and the doctor says, listen, you know, if you don't change your diet, this is going to be a disaster, 6 months tops. You know, can you just wake up and without an inciting incident start that process of change?
Sure. That's sort of the New Year's resolution approach to things. Oh, today I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to join the gym and I'm going to get healthier, or, you know, it's pervasive in our society. I think we were talking about it earlier that the culture of the United States is, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstrap, always improve, you can always get better. It's sort of the ideology of our world, if you will.
Do you think that's a healthy ideology?
Oh, yeah.
But what about self-acceptance? Does that have a place in this process?
That's the other, there's one of those models out there that says basically accepting helps you move towards different goals in your lives that are more important. So if you have a negative, if you have anxiety, for example, rather than boring in and focusing on that anxiety and trying to get rid of it.
Being obsessed with it.
The better thing to do is say, okay, I've got this anxiety, but you know what? I have more important goals in my life. So I'm going to accept this anxiety and live with it so I can go on and do these other things.
So, Katie, when someone's looking for self-help books in the library and you help them find the best resource out there in the library's collection, although sometimes they just need the call number, your job as a librarian does start kind of inching close to that of a therapist, doesn't it?
In a way, you could think of your library as a big self-help institution, and quite a few people do. We hear on our public service desks quite a lot of the similar stories, I'm sure, that Nancy is hearing. but we're not trained therapists or psychologists or psychiatrists. So we're always very careful what we don't try to offer any sort of advice or cures for the patron. That we're just not trained to do that. Instead, we listen to them. We take the patron to the first shelf that'll help. We suggest other materials that could supplement the research they're doing. And some of us might ask the patron, you know, would you like something to take your mind off your problems and find something fun in the fiction or something fun in narrative nonfiction or just something that'll just take your mind off this serious topic. And you just gauge the patron's mood at that point. So we hear a lot of that sort of thing. Another running gag in library world is we're biblio bartenders, but we know that we're not in a place to offer that sort of guidance and advice, that we're not going to make judgments.
But you know what's really interesting is we have a ton of data that says that what you're doing alone can be helpful.
Just listening at the desk?
Listening, forming a relationship.
Oh, yes, constantly.
Can be really powerful.
And just the idea maybe that you've taken a first step in reaching out to some other human being or some other resource, is that on its own? Is there any data on whether that on its own is beneficial, no matter how kind of quote-unquote good the help is?
Sure. I'm not sure how good the data are, but there are certain brands of therapists that will tell you that the first thing they're going to check on when a client comes in is pre-treatment change between the phone call and when they show up at the door. But the really big thing here is that we know that the therapeutic relationship is a very powerful part of what change happens in therapy. It's not all of it, but it's a big deal. And that's one of the criticisms of, say, a pure self-help sort of process is you lose that relationship element. So one of the trends in the self-help area that psychologists are studying right now is to what extent should we supplement pure self-help?
Do you think that that's the role maybe of that guru or that personality-driven author or presenter that, yes, it's self-help, but you feel like there's this other person who you're interacting with?
Well, in the pure model, like in the play, I'm not so sure it's the same kind of relationship as what I've been talking about. But I think it does give you a leader and an inspiration and somebody who's going to pump you up. And I think that helps.
Katie, what do we know about the history of self-help?
Well, I found a couple of things. The first little fact I found is that self-help books go back to an ancient Egyptian genre called sabbat, which is an instructional literature on life. And if I'm pronouncing that correctly, then sabbat means teaching. And it goes up into the early Middle Ages and the Middle Ages when these Mirror of Princes books told stories of kings whose behavior should either be imitated or avoided. And we could probably liken that to business self-help of today. And then it moves into the 1600s and 1700s where there were conduct books that told men how to behave in polite society. So think Emily Post etiquette books of the 1950s. And then it jumps. I could go on from decade to decade. But one of the most interesting notes I found was that the first book called Self-Help was written by Samuel Smiles in 1859. And
last name is Smiles?
Smiles, yes.
That's fitting. Okay, go on.
It is. And his book was urging readers to imitate men of self-made men of industry. Again, another business book. And he wrote that the spirit of self-help is the root of all genuine growth in the individual. What I found really interesting about Samuel Smiles' book, Self-Help, was that he could not find a publisher for his book, so he self-published his self-help book. And it sold 250,000 copies in 1859. That's quite a lot of copies in 1859. But self-help has just moved through the ages, and it's adopting – it adopts the personality of the decade. We were talking about this earlier, that in 1937, Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich – and then moving into the 50s, Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking. And then in the 60s when we see the New Age movement that David mentioned, which is just a rebranding of new thought. And it all reflects what's going on in the time. So we see New Age, the Beatles decide to hang out with the Dalai Lama, and there are some of the New Age self-help books. People are capitalizing on what's going on in pop culture.
Do the problems that people are predominantly trying to solve tell us something about it? I mean, what are kind of some of the big self-help titles right now? And do they tell us anything about kind of the ills of our larger society? People tend to think of their problems as their own individual problems. But if tons of people are all running out for the same self-help book, it speaks to a larger issue.
What I am seeing right now in the last couple of years, what's been published, what's getting popular, is self-help books that teach us how to distance ourselves from the drains technology has on our attention and our mental energy. Happiness, Gretchen Rubin's Happiness Project, is still a really popular self-help book. So I'm seeing a lot more that are based around technology and how we connect with other humans. Because the more our technology advances, some of the galleys and books I'm seeing now, the more we distance ourselves from other humans. And we say that it's so important for us to connect with other people, and then we spend so much time on our devices, even in the company of other people. And this is something I hear on the desk at the library all the time. It's why people like walking into their library and why they want to chat with someone at the desk to either tell them their problems and please lead me to the self-help books, or just come in and talk about their lives, form a relationship, talk about books or reading, anything. People don't want to just zip through their library unless that's really what they need to do. But they want to form a relationship. So libraries are still one of the places where we're holding all the knowledge that will help you make yourself a better person. But we're holding a lot of people that will help you find that knowledge.
And connecting with those people seems to be one of the main goals of today's self-help reader. Nancy,
yes.
When people are looking for self-help books to solve that problem in their lives or others, are there some red flags to look out for, or maybe guiding principles that would distinguish like a reputable book with psychological validity from some kind of maybe more commercial product that's likely to get you hooked on a series rather than helped in your life?
Wow, that's a really good question. And it's kind of difficult to answer because I think that, you know, your average my immediate response, of course, as a psychologist, is to say, you know, go for the one that's got the data behind it, you know, the reputable researcher, et cetera, et cetera.
How do you know that? Do you look like in the bibliography to see if sources are cited?
Yeah, that would be a good idea. You might look at where the person who's writing the book is coming from. That is, are they an academic type, or are they somebody that's just sort of with an unknown institute or something like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those books could be unhelpful either. That's the problem. I think there's a room for a wide range of approaches here. Yes, there are some that are out there, you know, bell ringing therapy, or I mean, historically, primal scream therapy is one of my favorite examples, that are probably not a good idea. You might sort of look around and search more broadly to see reviews of a particular approach, to see what the consensus is about this book or this approach. Is that helpful at all?
Central Standard's going to take one more break. Call us at 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about self-help. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. OK, Okay, let's pick right back up where we left off. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is Central Standard, and our guests this morning are librarian Katie Stover and psychologist Nancy Murdoch. We're talking about self-help and how people change. A new play opening this weekend, Help Yourself by David Wayne Reed, inspired this discussion. And Nancy, right before we went to break, you were talking about how to figure out if maybe a book has some credentials behind it before going down a lonely, possibly, path of self-help without someone else to intervene and say, hey, maybe that's not such a good idea. So we were talking about credentials of the author. How can those – and how those can sometimes be maybe misleading.
Yeah, it's – I mean, from a psychological perspective, you kind of want to know the person might have some training that's relevant to the area of helping people change. And kind of normally you want that to be a psychologist or a social worker or a counselor or something like that. But what you find is a lot of people write self-help books that don't necessarily have that kind of background. So I think we had some examples over here historically.
Yeah, Katie, right. In some of the research I did on the history of self-help, I think everyone knows that Dr. Laura Schlesinger is not – her degree is in physiology, I mean, but she doesn't have one in psychology or psychiatry. And I was surprised to learn that Dr. John Gray, the Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus author, he got a doctorate from Columbia Pacific University, which is a non-accredited correspondence college.
So that doctor in front of someone's name is maybe not sufficient.
Right. It's not sufficient, but but for selling books, it certainly adds a lot of gravitas to the author. People read that and they think, okay, this is a doctor of something or doctor of whatever this topic the person's writing the book on, since readers will naturally assume the author is the expert of the subject at hand. And then, Nancy, you mentioned Dr. Joyce Brothers. And tell me about her. I had no idea.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too
vociferous
about this because I can't quite remember, but I know that her degree is not like clinical or counseling psychology. She may be a psychologist. As a matter of fact, I think she is, but it's not a people-changing psychology degree.
So that's – but when you, one of the credentials you mentioned, something that could lend some credibility to a particular work or author is if they're getting positive reviews. And Katie, I wonder for you as a librarian, do people give you feedback of the books they've checked out? Do they come back and tell you like, hey, you helped me find the section on quitting smoking and here I am. I haven't smoked in a year. Thank you.
No, not for self-help, for almost any other subject. And certainly when I offer up suggestions for leisure reading, people like to come back and tell me, yes, I like this. No, I did not. But not with self-help. I think that that's one of those subjects that folks want to talk to you at first. And then if it didn't work, they're not going to come back and tell us it didn't work. Because one of the things we're learning about self-help, I think, is that it's an industry that's designed to be unsuccessful. Otherwise, it will fail.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, if all the self-help from the 50s and 60s really worked, and even from the 70s, would we have a self-help industry right now?
Would we need the books is the question.
Would we need the books? Would we need these self-help gurus?
Would you read a second book?
Would you read a second book? And actually, what the publishing figures do show is that folks who purchase a self-help book on a particular title are more apt 18 months or so later to go back and find another book of the same subject area, whatever their personal problem or fix they want to make in their lives.
Is there any outlier here, like a book that people check out and give rave reviews on again and again, or no, there's just no reviewing self-help in this informal talking to your librarian kind of way?
The one book that I'm hearing a lot of folks talk about that they like a lot is The Happiness Project. And that's because Gretchen Rubin probably boils it down to really simple things that you can do in your life. And she also offers the right kind of advice for us as readers with so many demands on our time, which is this is all the things that she did in her life. But pick two or three and make a change. Don't do everything. Just pick the two or three that work for you. So Gretchen Rubin is actually banking on the fact that most people who read self-help books aren't going to read the whole book. They may read the first couple of chapters and then flip through, or they may quit after the first 25 or 50 pages. And she's telling you right up front, this is how I want you to use my book. I've written a whole book, but, you know, use it piecemeal. Pick it up, put it down.
Nancy, is that a book that you're familiar with?
No, I have to say it isn't, but I like the approach. I was just reading a really recent self-help book by Bill O'Hanlon called Out of the Blue, and it uses the same strategy. In the first chapter, it's like gives you the six ways that you can deal with depression. Right up front, very concrete, very simple.
List of six.
Mm-hmm. I think it was six.
When you are taking on the project of making a change in your life, do you think that kind of limiting how much you're going to change at one time is helpful? Like you're not going to wake up and have perfect hair, be a perfect student, show up on time everywhere and exercise every day. You can't do that all in one day.
Definitely. I mean, I think that's a given that even the smallest change can help you spur onwards for more change. But you need to focus. And that's what all of these 16 approaches that I study help you do, is focus on what's important to change.
But that spurring onward, can that turn into kind of like an addiction to improvement and an addiction to self-help?
I guess it could. I was thinking about this person that goes the 18 months later and buys the next book. And some people that just take to that approach, you know. But I also think in another way that if you change something small in your life, it buoys you. It gives you confidence. It gives you a sense that you can go on and do whatever else it is you want to change.
What I think I see with some readers is that people who are interested in self-help, and almost any reader that wants to find a way to improve themselves or learn something new, everyone just has a particular subject that they have a thing that they're interested in. And if it's – there are lots of books on depression, and there are books on time management, and books on organization, and books on weight control. And if that's just where your concerns are in your life right now, then you will check out multiple copies or purchase multiple copies of a book on a particular subject. And it's not so much that the first book you picked up and read didn't work. The first one on time management didn't work. You're looking at the others to see if there are other different ideas, and you're putting them all together so you have one mental book of how to make time management work better in your life, or how to be more organized, or ways to combat depression, or different tricks and fixes to control your weight or control your smoking or improve your relationship.
And so that's the self and self-help as an active researcher who gathers many resources.
Yes. And so in a way, if the readers are checking out more than one self-help book, it's not so much, I would say, that the book has failed them. They're actually continuing to help themselves by check out more books and look for more I'm going to use this term you don't like, life hacks.
Yeah, I told Katie I didn't like that. Katie, let's talk about that term, because why a life hack?
Oh, I'm not certain. I heard that term and I thought, oh, life hack. It's the contemporary term for self-help. It's people like that. It resonates. It sounds like you found a trick, a secret that no one else knows, and you're going to share it with everyone. That's why everyone likes that term, Gina. I understand why you're not fond of it. And it makes it seem like the simplest things are like a duh moment. Like you should have known that.
I was listening to what you said about people getting multiple books and multiple different approaches too. I think it's important to make the point, too, that sometimes it's very difficult for us to change. And there are certain habit-based, particularly things that it takes multiple tries. So people
maybe just by default, it's going to take more than one effort to, like, get at this?
Yeah.
What are some of those things?
Quitting smoking, weight loss, probably the organization thing, too. But the notorious ones are quitting smoking, drinking, drug use. Usually take multiple,
really entrenched things in our lives.
Yeah, they take multiple attempts, and that the good news is that you shouldn't give up.
Yeah, well, this idea of self-transformation, it seems like the self-help piece of it is something that would happen in a part of your life that's kind of separated off from the day-to-day practice of it. Mm-hmm. How do you take the goal for change, whether you're reading a book or attending a seminar, and then reintegrate that into the nitty-gritty of daily life?
I guess just engaging on this hunt, this journey of self-help and deciding to do it would bring it to your consciousness, your awareness, it would make you more aware in your day-to-day life of whatever. And then in some approaches, you like set alarms or tie strings around your fingers to keep things in the forefront. So there are strategies you can use to move it into daily life so you don't just go on and do business as usual.
Katie, before we go, any changes you're seeing in the self-help industry from like a publishing perspective? Anything we should be on the lookout for?
Not subject-wise, aside from the growth in how we handle all the technology and how we make time for ourselves. I'm seeing a lot of time management, happiness, and technology balancing books, and also books that talk about the impacts technology is making on our lives, what changes it's making, and how we either stave off those changes or roll with them.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to David Wayne Reed for joining us earlier in the hour. And thank you, Katie Stover.
Oh, pleasure, Gina.
Katie's with us from the Kansas City Public Library. And Nancy Murdoch from UMKC's School of Education, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have that available later today. Tomorrow, Central Standard will be an encore presentation of a show on the vinyl renaissance here in Kansas City, with thoughts on the future of the music collection in a world with limitless options for listening to music and for storing it. Tune in. Central Standard is produced by Sylvia Maria Gross and Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.